like him or not like him, that stands for their talking about the Christian right and their issues. There's very, very little substance on healthcare. If one of the presidential candidates gives a major speech on healthcare, what they will do is say that Hillary Clinton gave a speech on healthcare today, and she said, in one quote that they thought was interesting. And that's the substance of healthcare. So there is no good way to get political information from the news, not the TV news. Radio news tends to be talk shows, and there are people, honest to goodness people, matter of fact, a whole lot of people who think, who do get their news from Rush Limbaugh and others of that ilk who are uninformed and who are intentionally uninforming people. Public radio, Minnesota's got a good dose of that, national public radio, there's a little bit of issue substance there. If I wanted to be a broadcast journalist, that's where I'd like to be, because you actually have a chance to do more than 20-second stories. At the Capitol in Minnesota, our state capitol, we have lots of reporters who've been doing political reporting on TV for 10, 15 years, and I keep thinking the same thing over and over again. I can tell you some stories get more clout than others. You can have a massive budget issue and debate about how we're going to spend money on human services. Has a real impact on people's lives. It won't ever be mentioned because it's just one detail of the budget, and even though it may affect thousands and thousands of people, it won't. One of my colleagues had a bill that I had actually worked with him on body piercings, making sure that teenagers had to get parental permission before you do it. And all of a sudden, you know, the media pounces on that because it's interesting and they can have good pictures of it and good, they can have good pictures of it. They can make it an interesting story that people are going to be interested in, and they'll sell television ads for their news program. So there's very little in any of those sources. The newspapers, very frustrating over and over again how little they cover. The internet, which had great promise for alternative sources of journalism, actually does have some of that. In the Twin Cities, I'm aware of three different initiatives. At least two of them are funded by nonprofits that are hoping eventually to make it so they can be self-sustaining. But they ask people to subscribe to them, but you don't have to. And they just, every day, they have headlines and they have commentators. A whole lot of the journalists from the two big Twin Cities newspapers that have been laid off in recent years, because they've cut their newsroom staff by at least a third, maybe closer to half, a whole lot of them bounce to one of these online services. So you do have a chance to get some journalism that way. And they take perspectives. You write a column, they will print it. I write a monthly column. If you want to see it, it's apple-pi.org. But it's available to anyone. And a lot of the, because I email it out to them, a lot of the journalists will put it on some of these websites. And people who have diametrically opposed views to mine, they'll put them on there too. They are interested in an informed electorate, which is what journalism is supposed to be. But we don't have a good way to get it out in the public, so it's very difficult to have a campaign which people are informed. Quickly about some of the issues, I think healthcare is, certainly it's on more people's minds than just about any other issue in year out, meaning over the next 3 or 4 years. I'm not sure it's going to be the big issue this year. Maybe the war will come back, depending on what happens with casualties or whatever. If Osama bin Laden is captured or killed in October, that'll change the whole election impact there. But I think healthcare is one that's not going to go away in a year. Energy prices, maybe not. But healthcare, it's just a growing problem. It's middle class. It's hit and miss. You may be middle class, you may be lower middle class and not have problems with it. But there are lots of people, even upper middle class people, who didn't realize it, but they got one serious illness and they went bankrupt because of it. They lost their job because they couldn't work. One of my colleagues who I've been working on my health care reform bill with, she's, I would guess, middle income family, lower middle income family perhaps. She got health care through her husband's job. She said, and this is 2 or 3 years ago, they were paying $900 a month in premiums, which is not shockingly high or low for health care premiums. It was a typical policy, $30 visit copay, $3,000 maximum out-of-pocket expense, and She happened to have two kids who developed special needs along later in life at age 9 or 10. And their daughter all of a sudden needed a 14-hour emergency spinal surgery. And the next day in the hospital, she was with her daughter in her daughter's room recovering, and somebody from the hospital comes in and says they want to talk with her about paying the bills. Oh, that's okay, we're insured. We've got such and such insurance. Oh, we know that. Surgery was $130,000. They cover about $70,000 of it. I'm not sure quite why, but with a $3,000 maximum out of pocket, she ends up with $60,000 in debt. This is a family that may make $60,000 a year, and they got two special needs kids and all kinds of other things. She wouldn't have known any of the problem of this. She may have been dealing with health care regularly with her kids anyway, but all of a sudden, her family's on the edge of bankruptcy. They're struggling, and they will be struggling for years. And getting health care, if anything goes wrong and they lose the job and they lose the health care, they're out of luck. And so health care, I think, because more and more people see that. We have it because kids graduated from college, all of a sudden no longer in parents' plan, what do you do? But health care is one of those issues that's going to keep building, and I don't think any of the presidential candidates this year are offering significant changes, if more which angle they're going to continue tinkering with. But that's going to be an issue that grows, and whoever does become president may well have a key role to play in changing that debate. Energy and environmental issues are ongoing, consistent ones with a percentage of the public. Energy has become one for everybody now. $4 gas, 2 years ago people would have laughed if you said that was going to happen. I mean, that's a wild prediction, but it has happened, and it's not likely to get much better. So I think that the whole energy issue and related to that the economy are going to be big issues. One issue I want to talk about very briefly before opening it up, and that is the immigration issue. Racism is not something polite society talks about anymore. It's, you would never admit you're racist. We may all have some of that in us. We all like to lump people in various categories, and racism is one of them. And you look at the polls, and it's out there, big and strong. And you can say, well, and most people, we had somebody in one of the sessions last week who was virtually in tears over the fact that Barack Obama may actually become president. Could you picture that 20 years ago, an African-American man getting elected president of the United States? That's earth-shattering. And then you read the stories of what his campaign goes through, stuff we don't see every day, but there are a couple articles, New York Times and other places, that talked about the racist attacks that his staff deals with regularly. So racism is out there, but polite society, we don't talk about that anymore. So now, who do we pin it on? We use immigration as a buzzword for it. It happens even in school districts. One of our suburban school districts in Twin Cities area was looking for a referendum for new funding because their school buildings are falling apart and they're short because they've had growing enrollment, and they were asking voters for approval of a referendum for more money. And the opponents to it, what did they do? They talked about all these outsiders from Minneapolis coming out to their suburban district and all the problems it was coming. Why should your property taxes, school district is doing that so they can import more people from Minneapolis? That was a buzzword for racism. I mean, this is people, Somali immigrants, Hmong immigrants, African Americans who lived there a long time perhaps. But they're coming into our school district. And it was a very clearly designed way of saying, there are these outsiders, there's these people of other races coming in. You don't say racism, but you talk about outsiders. In that case, it was just people from Minneapolis moving over. In other cases, it's people from Mexico coming here or from Somalia coming here. And the hatred over this issue comes, it hits so broad. There are a lot of people who really are people I think you and I would consider good people who don't want to be, who would be offended if somebody said that they were showing racism. But they buy it because they keep hearing it's those people, they're coming in, they're taking our jobs. If you're hurting high gas prices, souring economy, it's because we have to pay all the welfare costs for these people coming in. You can give them a long talk about how the economics work out and how these illegal people who are coming in and these illegal people who are not paying any taxes, but they're getting all the welfare benefits. Most states and federal government don't allow undocumented people to get welfare benefits. And if they're working in any way through false IDs or whatever, they're paying Social Security, and they can never get the benefits out of it. So they're paying more than they're getting out of it. But you can argue that point. It doesn't matter. Our governor put out a study. He had one of his agencies come up with a study, and it talked about all the additional burdens that immigrants were costing Minnesota. I don't remember how many million dollars a year it was, but it was sizable. And a lot of the groups, nonprofit groups, are saying, what about the other side? What about the benefits of them coming in? Because the neutral studies seem to suggest there's a net benefit, not a big one. And it doesn't mean that somebody might not lose a job because somebody came in. But the immigration issue is one that would be, I think it would be the biggest issue in this year's race, because it's a real easy one to divide on. It's a real easy one to create fear. Talk about all the crimes that are being committed. There's actually a study a year or two ago in San Antonio and other communities in Texas that the immigrant population, the undocumented population, was far less likely to be involved in crime, perhaps partly because they're afraid of getting caught and being deported, but that it was actually the opposite of what people thought. So I think that would be the biggest issue this year, except for one thing, and that is that a whole lot of immigrants of recent years are citizens, and they vote, and they're voting in larger numbers. And so it's been interesting to watch, even in the Republican presidential primaries. This one guy from Colorado, Tancredo, who was running, that was his theme, and he never had much standing and didn't get any more standing. He had this group of haters who were with him. But among the major Republican and Democratic candidates, nobody was out there. I mean, Giuliani and Romney had a little bit of a thing about who hired an illegal immigrant to come work in my kitchen, and how Giuliani had done something here, and they were fighting with each other who was more anti-immigrant. But that tended to be in certain circles in New Hampshire and Iowa. It wasn't something they were going to talk about in California or Florida. They were very cautious about it, and I think because there's a growing block, because our nation's becoming more diverse, it's keeping that from being the top issue. It's still out there, some small southern Minnesota towns. One of our congressional members is being under fire for that. And it's going to happen. There's going to be attacks on it on and off, but it's very measured, very cautious, because the Tancredos of the world didn't win on their hateful stuff, and others are kind of, politicians are dancing very cautiously about this because they don't want to offend people. There are plenty of other issues we could talk about. Last week there was a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on guns, said that people have an individual right to guns, regardless of whether it's related to a well-organized militia in the Second Amendment. That's it was a surprising decision in some ways, because it overturned what people expected from the courts from the last 70 years based on previous rulings, but that could come up as a big issue. But I want to open this up and steer it whichever way you want to talk about, whether it's foreign policy or guns or abortion or whatever. So, yes?
Just to go back to your discussion on immigration, we mentioned Florida and California. If there's any two states that the immigration issue from an economic standpoint is going to be sensitive on, is going to be those two states. You might also include Texas in that as well, but the economies of both of those states, I believe, would be heavily dependent upon legal or illegal immigrants.
The economy of California and Florida with and Texas with agricultural workers.
Yes.
Whenever certain people in the business community want to crack down on this, or lots of people the business community's worked with in Republican politics want to crack down on those illegal people. Somebody in one of the sessions was talking about how is a person illegal. People in Allen may have been the one doing it. People are not illegal. But these going after the workers, the immigrants, means a lot of the larger farming operations are worried. They're scared silly that they can't continue processing, especially certain fruits and vegetables that require very intensive work. And they're worried about it. And a lot of businesses, meat packing plants in southern Minnesota, They've hired a lot of people, and they're not all documented workers. And they are kind of torn because they want the workers, and the government, when it does crack down on immigration, it's going to be doing it largely through employers, and employers are worried about that. So the Republican Party itself is torn on it. And Florida is obviously going to be a swing state. California is not projected to be. I don't know that Texas is either, but Florida. And it's not just regular immigrants, it's the immigrants from Cuba too, because you got the interesting politics with Cuba and the immigrants there, because so many are voters there. But it will be a hot one.
Yeah. I'm interested in the, I don't know if it's going to be much of a campaign issue, but the question of how much we've spent on the war in Iraq, in combination with the tax cuts that the Bush administration championed early on, and my understanding are still in law.
In place.
And what sort of, I heard Barack Obama speak in Hartford, and at a certain point in his speech, he just started going down the list of the material consequences to our country because of not having that money that the tax cuts gave back to people, and then this money that's being spent on Iraq. And so I just wondered your thoughts on that question of basically funding the things that we need to do in order to be a constructive, positive, functioning society.
But it's an important point, because the number one thing that's killing our budget now is the war. Every previous war, people were asked to sacrifice, and we've talked about that a lot. The fact that this one, our sacrifice is to shop more. That was Bush's real comment after 9/11. Keep out there, go and keep shopping. It was very clear that that's how we're supposed to sacrifice. And I think there was I don't think it started that way, but I think the conscious decision became, you know, if we're going to pay for the war now, it's going to be a lot less popular. So we're just borrowing and borrowing and borrowing money. We cut taxes for the wealthy at the same time we build up this war. And I think the total cost of the war, the actual cost spent, is well over $500 billion now. And if you rebuild the military infrastructure that was destroyed, that we've used, always spent ammunition and weapons and so on, it's going to be another couple of $100 billion. And when you count the costs of people coming back and the lifetime medical bills and everything else and the pensions of the people in the military, that's going to add, the projections are, it's well over $2 trillion now. And I'm not ready to tell you the amount that each missile of various type, each of these surface-to-air missiles, each of these drone planes, everything, how many teachers you could hire for one of them. But I've seen those numbers.
Right.
And that there's that, I can't think of the website, some of you have seen it, thecostofwar.org or something, where you can calculate how much has been spent from your state, how much per household has been spent on the war already, and what effectively is bound because of what we've spent. And it is, taking just that amount of money and nothing more, one, we could come a lot closer to balancing the budgets, even if you didn't eliminate those big tax cuts. Number two, you could fund our schools, you could clean up the environment. It really is draining us, and our country, the national debt, it tripled all of American history's national debt tripled under Ronald Reagan, and it sort of slowed down the growth of it, and during Clinton administration actually started shrinking because we had a balanced budget for a few years, but now it's going the other way and going the other way fast. I do think that the permanent tax cuts, will not be made permanent. I don't think Congress will pass them that way unless the elections turn out much different than we expect. I don't think those tax cuts will continue, and that will help close some of the budget gap, but we are stuck. If we got out of Iraq tomorrow, we are stuck with presumably $2 trillion. So I don't think we can understate that. And I don't have the how many teachers you could hire, how many people you could house or whatever, but we could take care of an awful lot of our problems with just that money.
What do you think would be a more responsible tax response than, I mean, one of the things I feel is like, I pay my taxes, and this is what happens with my I'm paying for this. And I'm trying to think, well, what sort of tax structure should I advocate for that would more responsibly spend the money that I and lots of other people are paying every year?
Well, in terms of the most responsible thing in my mind would be first to undo those tax cuts for high-income people.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the tax bracket, the 70% top tax bracket we once had, you have a lot of countries where, not a lot, but you have some countries where the top tax bracket is 90-some percent. And if you're making $10 billion, you know, you still are going to be extremely wealthy with a 95% tax bracket. But 70% was the highest I think we ever had really in effect for a period of time. And then it dropped to about half that now, and then all the tax cuts that came in. I think the first thing we need, the way government should run, is basically on a progressive income tax structure. That's the way you shift dollars from people who have gotten large amounts of money, whose society has been given the best benefits to,
right.
They should pay most. And at the federal and most state level now, we actually have, for low-income working people, while the minimum wage is not nearly adequate, at least we've helped a little bit with earned income tax credits. So if you're a low-income wage earner, you file taxes, you really ought to, even if you don't owe any, because you'll get money back. It's sort of a negative income tax. And that, increasing the benefits for low-income people who can't support themselves on the income they make, and taxing more at the high end, that's the way we ought to fund government services. Anything, and I think it is reasonable to have taxes to discourage certain behavior or encourage certain behavior. You give tax credits for certain energy efficiency products, that's a good thing to do. Likewise, a gas tax, Minnesota, we raised it by 5 cents, and we were told this is going to bankrupt everybody, and gas prices go up by 20 cents the next week, and everybody, this 5 cents would really hurt now. And it goes up another 60 cents, and it gets a little funny. And I think it was encouraging that two of the presidential candidates, when they came out and asked for a president gas tax holiday, Obama said no. And he didn't lose support over it, which is what the fear was. But you want to have tax policies that encourage certain behavior. Reduce smoking. I've got a dime a drink tax for alcohol proposed that I've been trying for about 10 years that would fund chemical dependency treatment. It would reduce crime, it would save money, everything else, and it would be sort of a user fee. People who drink heavily would be paying more. And there's good policy reasons for that, but those taxes are very regressive. The lower your income, the higher percentage of your income you're spending on those taxes. So I think you need those taxes that have social policy benefits, but everything else should be coming from a progressive scale to make up for that. Sales tax is very regressive. Property taxes are usually very regressive and very unfair, inequitable between communities and so on. But I think the progressive income tax at the state is very important. Washington State has no income tax. Minnesota does. Some people, our media and others, keep saying we got the most progressive state and local taxes in the country. And that's factually false. We actually have the least regressive state and local taxes. In Minnesota, if you make $1 million a year, and there are plenty of people who do make $1 million a year, you will pay a lower percentage of your income in state and local taxes. It's probably about 7, 8, 9%, depending on the higher end you save more, lower percentage. If you're middle income or lower income, you're probably paying about 10, 12, 13%. So it's actually a regressive tax. The more you make, the lower percentage you pay. You pay more total dollars, certainly, but the lower percentage.
In Washington State,
too. In Washington would be very regressive because you don't have any income tax, right?
No, the poor by far pay the largest percentage.
And the only tax that we use in this country that is progressive is the income tax. And states, half the states don't have one. And most of them that do, ours is until they cut the taxes several years ago, was a 6, 8, and 8.5%. So there's not much gap between them. So it's very regressive even there. That's a long answer to
that. Yeah, no, very helpful. Thank you.
I was raised in a very progressive household, and I don't want to talk politics with my father anymore because he's 80 and he's become very, very depressed and there's no hope. And I respect them, but there's almost this hopelessness, and I'm thinking, Dad, I need to keep the hope, because my grandkids, you know, your grandkids, and I can see how you can become so depressed. I mean, my worst case scenario when Bush was elected, was appointed in 2000, is it's way worse than my worst case scenario was. But I need to keep that hope. And it's so, I know you talked about this yesterday, but how do we keep the hope?
Well, a couple of things. One, I think it's very useful to use the word hope instead of optimism. Yes, I didn't say hope. Okay. There may be good reasons he's ahead of the poll. And that's very important. There's a big difference between optimism and hope. There are times when it's very, very, very difficult to be optimistic, but hope is a more Christian term. We understand the difference there. Several of our talks, my talks here, you get into a lot of depressing things and how uphill the battle in front of you is. And I think one of the reasons people are so cynical, so pessimistic, is that leadership has gotten to the point, the way I was talking about it yesterday, a lot of the Republicans have been trying to say, government's a failure, government can't work, government's a waste of money, government is bad, government is evil. And those are the people running government for all those years who were hyping it, are right. Saying government doesn't work, it's evil.
Right.
And you picture that would backfire on them, but no, it's not the fact that they were bad managers, it was that government was inherently evil or bad. And Hurricane Katrina, I think it got to the point where some people really think, well, look how government flopped. While Bush is saying, Brownie, you're doing a great job. And week after, nobody in the country is thinking, what's going on? What's in his mind that he thinks this is a great job? But a lot of people really bought for the last 20 years or so that government was bad and harmful. And so that was the Republican message, and the Democratic response tended to be, yeah, government's bad, but we're not going to take any more of your money than we absolutely need. We're going to cut taxes. We've cut taxes. Democrats have cut taxes in Minnesota. I was the only no vote against the biggest tax cut in state history 10 years, 7, 8 years ago. Democrats voted overwhelmingly for these tax cuts. Not as big as the Republican ones. Not as regressive as the Republican ones. But they voted for it. Why? Because, we can't really fix these problems, you know, that's the political climate we're in. And same thing with healthcare, with poverty, with environment, with schools. We can't afford to fix the problems. We don't have a vision, we don't have an answer. Well, I think we do. I think people here, I think a lot of people in society want to have hope, they want to succeed, they want government to, and if they're appealed to, if you appeal to the good and the generous and kindness in people, they respond to that. And all they've had for 20, 30 years is appeals to fear. I mean, 9/11 is a perfect example. Appeals to hatred, the immigration issue we were talking about. Appeals to greed. Who can spend your money better, you or the government? And that was kind of the Ronald Reagan tax cuts was just to cynically say, government, they're going to take your money. We're going to protect you from the government taking your money. And I think the best thing we can do to build that hope is have people in the faith community, people in politics, civic leaders speak out about, no, that's not the way it has to be. This is a can-do nation. We've got this American dream. We think we're better than everybody else. And so if everybody else can provide health care for their people, maybe we could too. But I'd say that the fault with that is one party is saying, they don't want to try. It's bad, let's stay away from it. The other party is saying, well, we really would like to, but you know, we could never do it. It's not politically realistic. And so it's easy to get down and out about it, and that's what I think we very much need. And I think the message of hope is really appealing to people because they don't want it to be worse. They think we can do better, and we can.
As a follow-up to that, you've been alone in Minnesota politics for a long time. Are you finding yourself less lonely? Are you finding people?
The last election, 2006 election, I'll take healthcare. I was put in charge of the healthcare committee because I was being dumped, the first chair in 20 years that I know of, who was dumped from chairing the committee they chaired by their own caucus. I was too aggressive on environmental issues, which I thought should be a thing to be praised, not criticized. But they put me in charge of the health care policy committee because I guess I wouldn't cause much problem there. And it's, I think I have one term as chair of that, and I'll be bounced from that. But the reason I might be bounced from that, if so, is because there are so many new legislators. We had a quarter of our entire legislature was newly elected. A lot of them were change in party, new person defeating an incumbent, and it's amazing. Suburban communities like mine that have been traditionally more Republican, Democrats took over a whole lot of them, and it's interesting. Some of these folks I didn't know. My caucus had no clue they were going to win. And they went out there, one of them, guy, he's a tile layer. That's his profession. He does artistic tile laying in people's kitchens and so on. And he had never run for politics, and he ran and beat a 25, 30-year incumbent who nobody thought was beatable in a suburban district. What's his issue? Healthcare. And he said, I go door to door and talk to people. Business owners, they're saying we need to do something. And he's supporting my bill, which is something the Chamber of Commerce would have a heart attack over. But he and a whole lot of his colleagues, they really, the way I describe it is they think they were really elected to get something done instead of get reelected, which is what a lot of people think they're elected for, is to get reelected. And so I really sense there's been a major change in the last couple of years. I think another one can change. I think the biggest problem for people with my perspective is that we don't act, and the public gets cynical, and you guys took control of Congress and you didn't do anything. I think that's a big threat. I think people understand you're losing, but you got to fight for it. And so I feel a lot less lonely this year than I've had a lot of new people, especially on healthcare, who are saying we got to do something. And I think it's going to cut. Barack Obama is not a conservative Democrat. He's appealing to a lot of Republicans nonetheless. I'm in a Republican, slightly Republican-leaning district. I'm not a cautious person. And I win a lot of Republican votes. Why? Because they trust that I've got something, an idea, and they trust I'll be fair with them and try and do my best judgment. And they accept that. And I think that's what Obama's appeal has been with young people who have never seen politics like that. It's 40 years since we had politicians talk that way.
Segue that to my question about, it seems to me that, from what I've read, that the Obama, I mean, part of the success has been mobilizing the voters, and also the current strategy around getting out, you know, people that haven't been voting, including, you know, African Americans that haven't voted. I mean, how do you look at, you know, are you optimistic about that or hopeful about that strategy? I mean, the percentage of people that vote in presidential election is what, close to 60%
yeah.
of eligible voters?
Yeah. Minnesota's led the nation most years in the last 30 years on it, and our new Secretary of State actually thinks that's a good idea, unlike our previous one. And he's got a little 80% this year, which hasn't been reached since the 50s. And it might happen. We've got in Minneapolis the first, now there are two of them, and he was only elected 2 years ago, the first Islamic member of Congress, which has caused Barack Hussein Obama, as the haters say, has caused a lot of grief, because you wouldn't believe how many emails, maybe you all see these emails too, of people about how he got away, he refused to wear a flag, and he won't say the Pledge of Allegiance. He took his oath of office for Congress, not on a Bible, but on the Quran. Well, Obama's Christian, and he did use a Bible. Our candidate in Minneapolis used a Quran. And matter of fact, he did it very, very artfully. He went to the Library of Congress, and he asked for Thomas Jefferson's Quran. That really, I mean, if the internet people had enough brains to be sophisticated, they'd have real trouble by that. I mean, one of our founding fathers, his book, he used to swear. But this congressman is a very secure district. The incumbent, who is a decent guy, but very cautious, we can't really do much. You got to understand the political realities. This is a guy who, dynamo. He thinks he really ought to do stuff, and he's really been a leader on issues like that. Well, he's spending He's been asking for campaign contributions, as everybody does, but his goal is to get 20,000 more voters out of North Minneapolis, largely African-American, very often poor, voters who haven't ever voted. He got a lot of mouth for his race because African-American, first African-American in Congress in Minnesota, first Muslim in Congress in the nation, and people were ready for it. He got out, I guess he got 30, 40,000 new voters out last time. They went 20,000 on top of this. And with Obama on the ticket, I think he's optimistic he's going to get those 20,000 or more. Whether that happens elsewhere in the country, I think there's a lot of potential for it. And I think there are lots of groups who are working at it. Civic groups, nonpartisan groups are working to increase turnout in groups that have been underrepresented. And both candidates are obviously going to try and bring out people too.
Speaking of the whole Muslim thing, do you think that Obama's attackers are going to use rehash, or do you think they're going to come up with some new smear thing?
Both.
Okay, we can't predict what that will be.
You can't ever predict. I had a House member, we just picked up one of my House districts had a Republican who was beat a couple years ago, and my new House member was very, very cautious. I would argue she voted like the Republicans most of the time. And anything that looked, she campaigned pro-education and how the schools need more money, and that even a resolution to put more money in the schools didn't have any direct connection to a tax increase. She voted against because she didn't want to look like she was voting for a tax increase. I told her, well, you know, it doesn't work that way. You don't give them any issues to campaign against you on, they'll make them up. And that's really true. And matter of fact, it was amazing because in the 2006 election, they came in guns blazing at her about raising taxes. She didn't vote for anything that could come close to it. And they campaigned against her, and she kind of woke up and thought, wow, she lost a lot of people in her party. And the other party was just going to make up a tax on her anyway. What Obama will be, first of all, he has this new thing, I can't think of the name of the website, but a thing where they're telling their supporters, if you want the responses to all these smears out there, they're taking it head on. They're saying, we got to respond. We can't ignore the fact that they're just continuing to tell lies, that they're distorting things. Here's our spin on it. Here's the facts that you need to straighten out what they're saying is wrong. I think it's been very helpful, and they'll continue to do that. I think if people get used to that now, because all this crud has been coming out for months, if they're ready and people say, oh, here's where you go for the facts, here's the response, then if there's swift boat attacks at the end, they'll have a response. But I couldn't predict what they're going to hit them on.
Factcheck.org, too, that's not his site, but right. You can go, I mean, if you you have family members or whatever, or people that you get on one of those email things, you know, and I've gotten a couple of them. You know, I email back, and I've emailed back whole lists, like, you know, 100, 150 people. You don't know who I am, but and I've gotten some interesting responses. Yeah. But the Annenberg Center runs the factcheck.org, and that's that woman that's on Bill Moyer a lot on the Evening Journal or whatever it is on Friday nights. But that's. You know, that's good because it's sort of like, you know, it's University of Pennsylvania.
It's a chance to respond. Annenberg School does good things with that. Snopes, I think that's a commercial website, and they're not just on campaign stuff. All these scams about how, oh, this is the way people are robbing people now, we've got to watch out for this, or new threat to security, or do this, or this chemical is going to kill you, and you didn't realize it was your eggs in the morning or something. Snopes.com is a good one for, they tell you, here's the rumor, and they tell you the story, and, well, this one's been around since 2006, and here's some various variations of it, and it's exactly what you get in the email, and they tell you which ones are sort of true, which are false, which ones are accurate, and so on. But I think those fact-check sites will help people a lot.
Is there a chance we're heading toward a worldwide recession, and really, who's running the boat?
That's one of the problems we have. I mean, we don't have, I mean, our international body, the United Nations, is very weak. Largely are doing, but not solely are doing. But there's nobody in charge of the world economy, and we've been so dominant in so many ways. We spend more on military than everybody else in the world combined, I believe. We were a couple years ago, and I don't think that's changed. We were so dominant in the world's economy that we kind of, what we decided at the federal level, changed the world economy. Now, who was it, Iran decided they're not going to use dollars for trading oil anymore. People are moving away from us because we're losing our economic clout. But yeah, we still have such an impact that we're causing big harm in the world. In our mortgage scam crisis that causes problems here, has a ripple effect overseas. I don't know, I'm not a predictor of economics or much of anything, but I think there's some real concern about it. The biggest issue, and we talked about it last night on a discussion, the biggest issue is, are we going to be changing our economy in terms of the way we stimulate our economy is buying more things? We can't sustain that. We don't have a sustainable economy by any way, shape, or form, and worldwide we don't either. That's why I think there's a lot of hope, again, back to that candidate, whether he'll do it. Like, my belief is his healthcare system is worthless. His proposal is not very good. I hope for when he gets elected, he uses the soapbox, the power, his rhetoric. He's very skillful at that, and I think a lot of the world, Alan and others might be able to give better feedback on this, but I think a lot of the world, if we elect an African-American man who's got a vision as president of this country, they may be open to say, maybe we should take another look. Maybe they're going to change their policies and work with us instead of trying to bomb us to bits. And so I think the best thing we could do is stop the war in Iraq and stop starting other wars and start working for peace in other places. To me, that would be the single best thing we could do for the world's economy. Yes?
It seems like, at least in this conversation, a lot of the measurable and determining factors that are being accounted are economic. And certainly, life is more than money. And speaking of the cost of war, and just thinking about, is there an accounting or record or reporting or even an awareness of things beyond the economic impacts of war, looking at the measurables and the intangibles, you know, such as, infrastructure or, which gets into the cost of replacement, I understand. But then just the possible intangible of international goodwill. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, a couple of things on that. One, you were Peace Corps volunteers. You were a long time ago. Peace Corps and other things in the 1960s were sent out there as our country had so much goodwill for so long because not only did our country help defeat fascism in World War II, but afterwards we rebuilt not just our allies, we helped rebuild Germany and Japan. The Marshall Plan, there are a lot of people now talking new global Marshall Plan to rebuild things and use our investment. We don't have any money as a nation anymore, we're in debt, but to invest in other countries and invest in building goodwill. We've certainly caused enough grief around the world in recent decades. We could do a lot. The whole issue about what beyond the economics? Yeah, the moral issues about killing people. That's where the faith community, that's where most of the anti-war movement in this country is coming from. It's not, oh, we can't afford this. That's kind of a thing we're trying to use to talk about what the impact on everything else we do is. But yeah, the body counts, we're unfortunately far more concerned about the limited number of our folks dying than the fact that there may be many times that much collateral damage or whatever we call it for people in Iraq and countries around there. I think that the churches have been very good and people who are opposed to the war have been very outspoken in the fact that these are moral issues. I think all of these issues are moral issues and our hope. I mean, our hope is not. Alan's been talking about the Babylonian story of creation and the Christian story of creation. Which way are we doing? Well, our country's been number one in the Babylonian system. And going the approach of where we're going to love our enemies instead of kill them. Ibu Patel, what group is he with?
Interfaith Youth Corps.
Interfaith Youth Corps. I don't know if some of you know him. Impressive guy. He talked recently about how those who talk about war between Christianity and Islam, which there are plenty of U.S. generals, one of whom has been scolded for talking about this war, trying to heat up a world war, a clash of religions. He said, for people who want that, he said, do you really want 1.3 billion enemies in the world?
Yeah.
Think about that. That's a weird way to want to build friends, is to create enemies.
Yeah.
And so I think you're exactly right. I've talked about economics, but the whole reason for opposing war, the whole reason for wanting human development, is because we're supposed to care about people. And that's where the faith community is beginning to get more and more vocal, and it makes a difference. Other things, yes?
I work with a man who's a very conservative Catholic. He's a wonderful man, I love him dearly. It took me a whole day after the John Kerry defeat before I could talk to him about it, after I mourned for a day. And then I asked him what he thought what was the defining moment in the election? He said, I just can't understand how Bush won again when we're at war. And it didn't make any sense to me. And he said it was abortion and gay marriage. And I had this huge feeling of depression that we had 20 issues to be dealing with, all very, very important issues, and it came down to two. And he said that's what it was. Do you feel that that's going to be
change
a deciding thing this time around?
I'm hopeful. When you started telling the story of this, I was going to say, well, I'm not sure what he said, but I was going to say, I bet it relates to abortion.
Yeah.
And the reason it has such a strong impact is most people in any society don't think abortion is a good idea. They don't like it. It's more than just some tissue, more than just a liposuction of fat tissue. Mm-hmm. It's a potential or developing, or however you want to phrase it, human life. And we won't get to the rhetoric about it. But most people, and I'll guess 99.5% of people, don't like abortion. A good number of people think the way they express that disapproval is to say, well, what do we do? How do we responded, well, let's make it illegal. And that's what they decide. And they're told by a whole lot of presidential candidates and legislative candidates everywhere up and down the ticket that abortion is a moral issue, it's killing babies, and we should make it illegal. We've now had a Bush in the White House for next year, it'll be 12 years, plus 8 years of Reagan, that's 20 years in the White House. All of them strongly pro-life, meaning anti-legal abortion, make abortion illegal. 20 years in the White House, and we're no closer to having abortion be illegal in a broader sense than we were at the beginning. And they say, well, we need the Supreme Court, and they're getting close. They don't need the Supreme Court. Why do they need the Supreme Court? Because the Constitution protects that right. All they have to do, and they've had almost two-thirds majority, all they have to do is pass a constitutional amendment to ban it. And maybe they lose. But on gay marriage, it didn't stop the Christian right from saying, we're going to offer amendments to it. Even if we lose, we're going to fight it. Abortion, they didn't offer any. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. One, it's a good political issue to keep out there. Number two, if it became illegal, all of a sudden there'd be such a backlash that it would permanently change things around. But number two, they're scared even getting too personal about what it means to make it illegal. George Bush Sr., when he was running for president against a caucus, they had one debate with somebody asked him about, do you think abortion should be illegal? Yes. What else do you expect him? That's his position. Well, does that mean we should arrest the women? No, don't arrest the women. You can't arrest the women. They're the victims of it. Well, okay, then how about the doctors? Yeah, because you got to arrest somebody if it's illegal. You got to do something to punish somebody. So you arrest the doctors. Well, Jim Baker, whoever his campaign manager was at the time, was in the media room outside the debate spinning. That's not what he meant. Before the debate was over, he didn't have a chance to ask him what he meant. He knew that's disaster. You can't really make it illegal unless you're going to lock people up. And the thing is, all these people who don't like abortion, there are some, they're very sincere people, it might be 1, 2, maybe 5% of the population who think abortion is murder. If I abort an 8-week fetus, it's the same thing, the same moral equivalent of taking an 8-month-old baby and shooting him in the head. There are people who believe that, but not many. Most people think, you know, a six-week fetus is a lot less of a developing human life than a six-month fetus. And a six-month fetus certainly is not equivalent to a six-month-old baby. They see it in a little more shades of gray. But so if you want to express your opposition to it, how do you do it? Saying, well, you're going to try and make abortion less needed by prevention and so on, which I think pro-choice folks have done far too little of. Talking about adoption options and far too little of that. But I think that that's where it's been. So what it means is these folks are all convinced George Bush is trying to stop murder of innocent babies. And John Kerry is, he wants to murder innocent babies. He even says he thinks, you know, I think abortion is immoral and it's murder, but, you know, I don't think we should make it illegal. Well, he lost everybody's votes on that. Nobody agreed with that. But we've got people who want to express their opposition to it. And they got one side saying abortion is murder, we're going to fight to change it. They won't offer any constitutional amendments. They don't really want to change it, but they vote for him. And because they think George Bush is a saint, if he's going to protect against this. John Kerry, because he wants to abort these babies, he's a sinner. And so anything Kerry says has got to be evil or bad, so they don't trust anything he says. And everything Bush says, they trust. It can be so counter to any other evidence they see about the economy, about the war, about everything else, but they have to believe he's right because he's the saint.
Will that be happening again?
It certainly happens to a certain point, and it will for a percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. I think that percentage falls. I mean, I think 27 or whatever percent popularity George Bush has now, that certainly those hardcore abortion is the issue. People have never given up believing on Bush. So it's less than 27% of the population, because there are plenty of others who support him too. But the number falls when the economy gets sour, when people are losing their health care, when they see their kids or their neighbors' kids coming back from Iraq wounded and with head injuries they're going to have for the rest of their lifetime. So it does change things, and it does go up and down. And the other change that's making that different on the issue is some Democrats, including Obama, are openly talking about their faith and their values. I have 100%, 0% record from the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, the anti-abortion, 100% rate from the pro-choice group, 0% from them. And I'm very anti-abortion. I just think the way you do it is by preventing unintended pregnancies, giving people other options, making sure that a mother who decides to keep her baby is able to raise that kid without spending the rest of her life in poverty. I talk about those things, and I talk about how my faith leads me there. On gay marriage, I wrote a column a couple of years ago when it was really, really controversial, talking about my faith makes me want to encourage people to marry each other, want to encourage people to make a lifetime commitment. And I can understand other churches think it's wrong, and they should have their right to, and nobody should ever force them to marry somebody they don't think. If they think a 60-year-old shouldn't be able to marry a 30-year-old, they shouldn't marry them. And they should have every right not to. But if my church believes it's right to let a couple of guys who love each other and made a lifelong commitment to marry each other, they ought to be allowed to. And I'm talking about from a faith perspective. Mm-hmm. Not that we should change the laws because of faith, but we should recognize my faith values should have equal merit to their faith values, and the Constitution and our laws should be neutral on that. I think if we talk about those issues, the people who are voting Bush because he's a saint on those issues and everybody else has to be evil, they start thinking, maybe that's not the way it is. Maybe we've been misled that way. And because we've gone over, I'll just close with one more comment on that. My father used to talk about some of the priests at Notre Dame. Younger priests would often serve as kind of counselors to students. And he said a number of them had talked about how they'd have occasionally a couple come in, and, you know, second, third year students, and father, you know, we had something that really happened terrible, and she got pregnant. It would have killed off both of our careers, our school. She would have had to drop out of school. So we had an abortion. We feel just awful about it. And, you know, kind of, how can we make up for this? Can we get involved in the pro-life movement or something like that? I mean, wait a minute. They're trying to say, we did something wrong. We think it ought to be legal, but, you know, how do we make up for it? Maybe we should try and make it illegal. That's just backwards. So I think the 90-some percent of pro-life voters who really aren't wanting it to be illegal. They want it to be less common, and they want to do everything possible to express their objection to it. I think when Obama and other candidates start talking about their faith and their values, I think people are open to that, and I think it will change things. And I don't think it won't be as big as it was 4 years ago. I think it might slowly change if people on the other side of the issue start speaking out. So, thank you for your attention.